This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this show on Free Speech TV nationwide and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates. Every year, millions of Americans rely on food banks and pantries to feed themselves. Donations to food banks are considered one of the most effective ways to combat persistent hunger in the U.S. But what many of us don't realize is that food charity was meant to be a response to an emergency, not a sustained means of feeding the hungry. After all, shouldn't ending hunger and ending the need for food charity be the ultimate long-term goal? Not according to many of the corporate board members of so many food banks in the U.S., who, according to my guest, are part of a sinister food industrial complex that refuses to address income inequality and low wages as a means to end hunger. Andy Fisher is a community organizer, educator, and the author of the book Big Hunger, The Unholy Alliance Between Corporate America and Anti-Hunger Groups. Welcome to the program, Andy.
Thanks for having me, Sonali.
So let's talk about this history first, how it was that this kind of industry, this web and network of food banks came about to begin with in the United States. We might imagine that they were always there, but that's not so, right? How did food banks emerge as a response to an emergency?
Sure. The first food bank was created in the late 1960s in Arizona. They grew slowly into the 1970s, but really exploded around 1980, 1981. And what happened then is we got into a deep recession. President Reagan came in and slashed the food stamp program, and also a lot of the manufacturing jobs in places in the Rust Belt, for what we now know as the Rust Belt, left. So there was some deep unemployment, some folks were really hurting. So labor unions and churches and others took this model of food banks, and they exploded dramatically. From a handful in the late 1970s to about 200 through the Feeding America network right now. And now we have about 60,000 food pantries and soup kitchens in the country. They serve about 45 million people, and they distribute about $5 billion worth of food. So you can see it's snowballed really out of our control over the past 35 years.
And so these are basically all over the country, right? Most cities have food banks, communities have them, churches are involved in them. And what is the sort of messaging around food banks? Because, you know, we know particularly around the holidays, it's considered the right thing to do, even for progressive or social justice organizations to collect food for food banks. What is the messaging that these food banks kind of present to the country in terms of how they tackle hunger?
You know, you're right. On one hand, you know, to give credit where credit is due, the Emergency Food Network, which is this kind of compilation of food banks, food pantries, and soup kitchens, you know, really is it's a testament to American ingenuity. As you said, they're all over America. They're embedded in churches and schools and civic associations and the Rotary Clubs. The post office does food drives. You know, it seems like it's everywhere. Tens of millions of people volunteer and donate food. The messaging, you know, has evolved to a point where it's largely that charity can solve the problem of hunger. It talks about fighting hunger, talks about donating food. You can be a part of the solution, and all it takes is your participation by writing a check or donating food. So, you know, from my perspective, there's an element here that's a bit misleading. You know, it really doesn't talk about that hunger is a symptom of poverty, or that, you know, poverty itself is in some ways a symptom of powerlessness. It doesn't draw those conclusions upstream to the real causes of hunger, but really takes a very shallow approach to treat the symptoms. And the other part of the messaging is that all too often anti-hunger advocates focus on childhood hunger. On one hand, there's some very real problems with childhood hunger, much more severe than adult hunger in terms of learning, in terms of brain development and the like. But on the other hand, they're cherry picking. You know, they're picking the most vulnerable of our citizens, the most vulnerable of our residents here in the country, and using them as a poster child for hunger. And what it does is it reinforces this distinction between the deserving poor and the undeserving poor. And, you know, the undeserving poor are those that society considers to have made mistakes, to have led an immoral life, that they deserve to be poor, deserve to be hungry. No, they don't deserve to be hungry, but they deserve to be poor. And the deserving poor are those like children like veterans, perhaps, the aged, perhaps, who by no fault of their own are they in a tough situation.
So let's also talk about the experience of using a food bank or pantry, which you discuss in your book. I mean, obviously, food banks do help poor Americans just survive day to day, and it's it would be hard to come up with an argument against having them all together. The question that we're discussing is what's the long-term plan to end hunger, but also let's stop along the way and explain to us what it's like to use a food bank and why that should also be part of the conversation.
Sure, and if I may, I'm going to tell quickly the story of being a volunteer at a food pantry. I decided, as part of researching this book, that I needed to volunteer at a food pantry. So I chose one based upon my recommendations from some colleagues over at the Oregon Food Bank, where I live in. I live in Portland, and I picked a food pantry that was in the basement of a church, which is not uncommon. And it's kind of a dark and dingy basement. People come in, they take a number. The pantry is only open at certain hours, so there's a big line. They take a number so that they're random served in a random order. Sometimes people have to wait a few hours. On my first day, I get an orientation from a teenager who is doing her community service there, and she tells me that my job is to be a cross between a personal shopper and a security guard. So with those, with those instructions in my head, I go off on my 4-hour shift. And I come upon about halfway through, I come upon an elderly couple who is sitting there. They're tired, they're dejected, and I, because they've been waiting for 2 hours, I introduce myself. And I should mention that this is a shopping pantry, which is really meant to confirm our dignity. So it's laid out like a grocery store, and people are able to get a certain amount of food based upon the size of their family and what's available. So I introduce myself. I ask them the size of their household. I get a shopping cart and some boxes, and I start taking them around the layout of the pantry. And I realize as I'm doing this that I am watching them. I'm watching what they're putting in their shopping cart to make sure they don't take too much. And I realize, I go, this is why am I doing this? So I take a few steps back to give them some space, but I realize I've got these instructions ingrained in my brain about, being a security guard and making sure they don't take an extra bag of spaghetti or extra can of tuna. And I'm still watching them, and I feel oppressive. And, I think what comes out for me is that this is, I'm a white middle class person. This is a couple, the person, a couple of color, and I'm trying to make sure they don't take a few extra cans of beans or a few extra cans of
Right. I mean, what would they do with that extra food but eat it, right?
Exactly.
They're not selling cans of beans on a black market for profit.
So the point is that there's an inherent power dynamic within that structure that I felt trapped in. And then when I reversed it and decided to be a client to check it out, I felt the same thing. I felt humbled. I felt put down. I felt that I felt the stigma, I guess, of and the resentment of having to rely on others for my meals.
So let's talk about who runs these food banks and pantries and some of the corporate players that are involved, and the benefits they receive from donating their surplus food to food pantries, which may start to give us an idea for why they don't come out and support increasing the minimum wage or other very direct measures to address income inequality, which is what causes hunger in the first place.
Sure. And just to kind of give you a lay of the land, there, as I mentioned, there's about 200 food banks in the country, and they're kind of at a wholesale level. They're, for a region. Like, for example, the Los Angeles Regional Food Bank covers the metro region. And then they serve a bunch of agencies at the ground level, perhaps those churches or other kind of YMCAs or Salvation Armies that kind of work at the community level. So it's the food banks that are very much kind of integrated into corporate America. They're very much kind of a downstream appendage of the food industry. They get significant amounts of their food from grocery stores, the waste of grocery stores, or from food processors, or through Feeding America, again, this trade association that works out of Chicago that works with manufacturers to get their leftover products. But what you also see is that who is on the board of food banks tends to be Very corporate. I did an analysis of 3/4 of the food banks in the country, 150 food banks in the country, that I was able to get data on where their board members work. And I found that of those 2,800 board members that I was able to identify, that almost exactly 1/4 worked at a Fortune 1000 company, so one of the 1,000 largest public or private companies in the country. So you've got them very much integrated into Walmart, into the grocery store industry, into the food industry, the food processors, but also into many other sectors of the economy, especially banks. And what happens with those board members is they tend to tamp down the policies of the food bank. They tend to, while the staff may be very liberal, may be very progressive, and want the food bank to work on minimum wage, to work on affordable housing, to work on upstream issues, that because they know they affect poverty and affect who's coming in their door, you see that the boards will hold them back from moving in that direction, because in many times it counteracts their interests, such as, raising minimum wages is something that's very much anathema to the supermarket industry, because they're very sensitive to those costs. So they get, they get tax deductions for their donations in the order of about $200 million a year. They get the positive publicity, the earned media, the halo effect, if you will, of being a donor and being able to think of themselves as hunger fighters instead of hunger causers, as, for example, Walmart is. But they also get, they get to control a sector that they potentially could be acting against their economic interests.
Let's also talk about the quality of food that's involved here. We have this tendency to think in terms of all calories being equal, but we know that's not true. You know, you wouldn't feed if you are a person of means, you would you're pretty picky about how what you feed your child, for example. But in the world of the hunger industrial complex, as your book calls it, the quality of the food that's essentially dumped on the hungry is quite patchy at best, right?
That's correct. I mean, again, to a large extent, although this is changing to some degree, that food banks tend to be, as I mentioned, kind of downstream of the food industry. It is not the highest quality foods that are going into the first rate, the top shelf stuff that is going into food banks. It's the bread that's a day old. It's the lettuce that's starting to wilt. It's the, perhaps the dented cans, or the experiment that a food processor made that they can't sell, or
And
the
in
oat.
general, food that has a long shelf life, processed food.
It does. Although I must say, there is a big move within the food banking world, especially in California, to change that. There
Right,
are
where
many.
farmers markets accept SNAP benefits, which is pretty
Right.
amazing.
There, yeah, and there is a program in California called the California Farm to Family Program that gets high quality produce from the industry that is distributed to farm, that is distributed to food banks. So you have some food banks in California that about half to 2/3 of what they distribute is produce. So California is in a very privileged position because of its own produce industry, but that's not the case in many other parts of the country. So the quality is something that is being improved upon, but you still see a lot of soda, a lot of cupcakes, a lot of baked goods, a lot of kind of junk, and not top quality stuff, really kind of off stuff, off brand stuff that is being distributed through food banks. It's the waste of the system in many ways.
Right. So the big corporations that produce the stuff have somewhere to put the stuff that doesn't get bought and eaten, and then they get tax subsidies for it.
Exactly. They get a tax credit halfway between wholesale and retail, so they're able to make a profit actually out of that tax credit.
So Andy, I mentioned SNAP benefits. So we have food banks and pantries. That's basically charity. Then you've got welfare. You've got SNAP benefits, supplemental nutrition assistance programs, which is basically what our original sort of welfare food stamp program evolved to. And that's direct government assistance funded by our tax dollars. How does that fit into the picture of the hunger industrial complex? Because that too is a st should be, you would think, a stopgap measure intended to help families sustain themselves while they are able to, while they are looking for a job that actually pays well. But the problem, of course, is our economy just doesn't support well-paying jobs.
Right. And so, SNAP, there is about $66 billion that goes into the SNAP program annually. It varies depending upon how many people are on the program. It is absolutely a bulwark against hunger. It is a very vital program that minimizes food insecurity among the public, and it is a program that desperately needs to be strengthened. The benefit rates are quite low, about $1.40 a meal, so it's very hard for people to make do on that. Part of the issue is that about 60% of the households who receive SNAP that are not elderly are working. So SNAP because we have such a low minimum wage, SNAP has evolved to a point where it's become a work support program. So as taxpayers, we are subsidizing corporations for the low wages that they pay by having workers help make their ends meet through getting on the SNAP program.
And yet you have the Republican Party in particular constantly trying to either do away with SNAP or put on increasingly degrading standards or conditions to get SNAP benefits, such as drug testing, et cetera. And then these are the same forces that, of course, support corporate America's drive to keep the wages low and refuse to support a higher minimum wage.
Absolutely. You know, there's this old trope of the welfare queen and this perception among the public that the SNAP, again, are the undeserving poor. They're the people who are too lazy to work. You know, I think the point I want to drive home, though, is, you know, again, there's $66 billion of SNAP. There's another $20-ish billion in other federal food programs, such as the WIC program, school lunch program, and there's 15 programs in all that USDA runs. By and large, though, most of the money that is going through those programs is going to corporate America. You know, the front end of the program is going to the needy, you know, to the school, the kids eating school lunch, or to the families using SNAP. But the one thing that's really never been really brought to light in the public forum has been who's profiting from that money. And the fact is that most of that money is going into the hands of big retailers, big grocery processors, food service companies, and the like. So those are companies that are causing harm. And they're causing harm to our environment, to our rural communities, to public health. So I ask in my book, why are we doing it this way? Why are we not using this huge trough of federal dollars in a way that reduces poverty, that generates jobs, that fills tax coffers, that protects the environment and rural communities better than we are currently? Couldn't we be using this money to transform the food marketplace rather than follow the food marketplace?
Well, on that note, Andy, I want to thank you so much for joining us today, and also for our KPFK and Southern California audience. I want to let them know that you're going to be speaking on Tuesday, August 1st at 6:30 p.m. at an event organized by the Santa Monica Farmers Market events, and that's happening again Tuesday, August 1st at 6:30 p.m. at the Gallery Food Hall, 1315 3rd Street Promenade. The event is free and open to the public. We'll post information about that from our website, risingupwithsonali.com, later today. Thank you so much, Andy Fischer.
My pleasure, Sonali. Thank you.
My guest is Andy Fischer, a community organizer, educator, and author of the book that we've been discussing, Big Hunger, The Unholy Alliance Between Corporate America and Anti-Hunger Groups. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo.